Chronic fatigue syndrome is a pathological condition affecting 2.5 million Americans and 30 million people worldwide. CFS is characterized by persistent debilitating fatigue and other signs of physical dysfunction, along with secondary psychological effects. While the record of cases dates back more than 80 years, it's only in the past 30 years that clinicians and scientists have combined efforts to search for underlying causes, a common diagnosis, and effective treatment. We'll look more into the effects, history, research, and management of chronic fatigue syndrome next on MediaMeet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's MediaMeet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are family physician with UP Holistic Medicine, Dr. Scott Dowdy, and chronic fatigue syndrome patient and activist Kelly Parks, who joins us via Zoom from Berlin, Germany. With me on the panel, Mining Journal staff writer Christy Beck. Welcome. Let's begin with a description of chronic fatigue syndrome itself. Accounts include a collection of ailments. We mentioned debilitating fatigue, general weakness after exertion, pain, some cognitive and neurological problems. Dr. Dowdy, can you give us a more coherent idea of what we're talking about here?
Perhaps coherent.
Or is there one?
Well, if we look at the name of the disorder, mm-hmm. MECFS, myalgic, that's muscles.
Okay.
Encephalomyelitis, that's brain mm-hmm. inflammation. Chronic fatigue syndrome, that's energy, that's exhaustion. This is a syndrome or disorder that's also been called, I believe, severe exercise intolerance disease.
Mm-hmm.
So
and some less respectful things.
Yes,
as well.
It is very much a mixed bag, and therefore coherent is a lofty goal to try and describe it.
I see.
Is chronic fatigue syndrome almost an underwhelming way to say it? It sounds like you're just tired all the time and that's it, and you just have to buck up, and I think that's the problem with getting people to take it seriously.
It is part of the problem, is when somebody's tired, they're subject to all kinds of opinions from the people that are observing that tired person. The CFS patient goes beyond sleepy or not quite as alert as the people that they're with might hope they are. They are downright exhausted and don't even feel rested after a lengthy bit of sleep.
I see. Cases appear to differ from patient to patient. The lives of some are almost completely overwhelmed with CFS, while some are able to pace themselves to establish some level of function. How would you describe that? Wouldn't those sorts of variances be a problem in diagnosing it in the first place?
For sure, yeah. The difficulty for some begins with even going to their doctor with the complaint that they're tired. And that, in a 10-minute doctor's visit, could end up being a blood test to make sure they're not anemic,
okay.
A thyroid test to make sure that they're not hypothyroid. And then if those things are fine, maybe medicine for depression, because this must be something in your head.
Gotcha.
That feeds the frustration both on the patient's side and the doctor's side.
Okay. Kelly, how problematic are these
different... Yeah, I can just add something.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. I wanted to add something to what Dr. Dowdy said.
Sure.
Again, with the depression and the ME, and this is something that a lot of doctors have trouble with differentiating between. And I think one way to clearly define what is depression and maybe what is ME/CFS is to ask how the patients feel after exercise, if they're experiencing something called post-exertional malaise. And this is a pretty clear indicator. If they're feeling worse after any mental or physical exertion, that it could be CFS. Another very important tool is to maybe ask what would they do if they could make a list of what they would like to do with their life if they were feeling well. someone typically with ME/CFS would have a list with many things. These people are frustrated. They want to get back to living. Whereas often if it's something like depression, there's a lack of motivation there.
Okay. I was going to ask you, how problematic are the differences between patients? Is there a problem, for example, in finding the right doctor, one that would suit you, or even in applying for insurance, although your insurance is different in Germany, right?
It is. I'm covered by the state-run insurance here in Germany, so I don't have much experience with it in the States, although this is a reason for us not living in the States. We will continue living here because the situation with insurance can mean that you are financially ruined if you don't have an insurance picking up the costly medical expenses and tests that one has to go through looking for treatment or a diagnosis.
This is one of the benefits of national health insurance, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Let me ask Dr. Dowdy about that. What about insurance? You know, we have insurance companies have a certain independence in some of these issues. Is it tough to find an insurer for this kind of treatment? It's expensive.
Well, the insurance world is somewhat of a moving target, mm-hmm. and I personally stepped away from that in my own practice because I wanted to devote my attention to taking care of patients, not taking care of the relationship that they have with their insurance company, which is largely a business-driven relationship. So to answer your question, mm-hmm. This is a real hot potato because while it might be the holistic doctor's dream, it could be the insurance company's nightmare because the treatments are varied. Many of them don't work. Lots of things get tried, and we hold on to what might be working, and then we run tests and we see if it's working. And insurance companies like resolution. And sometimes that resolution is not pleasant, but they still like the end of the relationship of the high-cost patient.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, you know, as you mentioned, in talking about the right doctor, I'd like you to say a little something that would help people understand holistic medicine as opposed to the ordinary practitioner you might walk in some office.
Sure, yeah. I get this question a lot, and what I typically say is that the holistic physician has a different toolkit, mm-hmm. A different toolkit that includes other tests besides the standard blood chemistry panel, blood count, thyroid, TSH, cholesterol panel. Many people who don't feel as good as they used to feel get that panel of tests and it comes up normal and the doctor says, see you next year. You know, the holistic physician dives deeper into how a person is functioning and explores areas that they may not be functioning optimally. Mm-hmm. So in a case like an ME/CFS patient, or even a patient who just has plain old fatigue, I would be going beyond not only in my assessment of that patient, but in my treatment of that patient. And so the treatment toolkit also is bigger. Deeper, broader.
And you have a relationship there. Isn't that something like what family doctors used to do?
It's why I got into family medicine in the first place. And it's in jumping out of the mainstream medical model and into a holistic medicine model, I have absolutely discovered the dream job when it comes to how I thought I might play a role in the lives of my patients.
I see.
It really is, it's a lot about time. I've already alluded to the 5 to 10 minute visit where the doctor is strapped for time.
Sure.
There are two more exam rooms filled next door, and that physician knows that they got to be wrapping it up shortly after they begin it in order to get on to the people that are in the rooms and in the waiting room. Holistic medicine really puts time up front and says, we're not going to do good work together unless we commit the time to getting to know you, getting to know the problem, talking about strategies for evaluation, strategies for treatment.
Yeah, this would seem to be key.
Yep.
Christy had mentioned that there was a long time when people doubted the condition was more than psychogenic, that it caused some sort of mental problem. It's been called a form of hysteria. At one point, someone, I think tongue-in-cheek, called it the yuppie flu, because flu sometimes involved in onset. What's the clinical consensus this day? What was that turning point in considering CFS a physiological pathology, a body disease?
Boy, I don't know exactly when that took place. Yeah. Kelly probably has a better sense of what the timeline is on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
What would you say?
I think we're still waiting for that to take place. And although the World Health Organization recognized ME/CFS in 1969 as a neurological disease, we are still fighting this battle. Doctors still deny that this is a organic disease, and we're still waiting for more funding from the government, too.
Okay. This psychological, there was a kind of a psychological bias that I think could be identified in the fact that 70% of the CFS sufferers are women. It's not that they're not, but there's a bit of a bias applied because of some things traditionally, some old outdated stereotypes. For example, hysteria would be a good example. From what we know, what does the overall CFS population look like? Why are some disproportionately represented?
Well, we know that ME/CFS affects people of all ages, races, and ethnicities.
Okay.
But it's true that it affects 75% or 70% are women. But this really doesn't come too much of a surprise when you think that 80% of autoimmune disease cases are women. Okay.
Right.
And we've seen this also in the past. Historically, we know also other autoimmune diseases such as MS or lupus, for example, were written off as hysteria. And women with MS, for example, were institutionalized. And it wasn't until the CAT scan came along that they were able to look inside the body and see these lesions and take it seriously.
What about children in terms of the population?
If children are affected,
yeah,
they are also affected. I think the youngest age documented has been 5 years old. And this is one of the main reasons for them not being able to go to school. And it's very difficult to detect in children because they don't really have the words to explain what they're experiencing. And it's often thought to be them behavioral.
Mm-hmm. I see. Today, the condition is generally referred to by the acronym, you mentioned it, ME/CFS. It was in the 50s, I think, that the name myalgic encephalomyelitis came up. The chronic fatigue syndrome thing came along in the 80s with outbreaks in Nevada and New York. How many cluster outbreaks have there been? I counted at least a half dozen. But there are probably more. But I guess the main question here really is, what do cluster outbreaks tell us about the condition? I mean, we're not talking about a contagious disease, are we?
We don't know for sure. The cluster outbreak starts to suggest mm-hmm. that there's a contagion involved. And it may be that that particular infectious insult happens to trigger this ME/CFS response or cascade of responses in the body
okay.
that were initiated by an infectious etiology.
I see. Okay. Kelly, can you tell us a bit about your background and the onset of your case of CFS and how physicians have responded?
Sure. I moved to Berlin, Germany 14 years ago, and 2 years after I moved here, I was studying to pass my exams to continue my studies here in Germany. And that's when I came down with this mysterious illness that could not be explained. I mean, I was so sick to the point that I thought I was dying. I questioned how possible that my organs were able to continue functioning properly because the exhaustion was so intense. And it was extremely frustrating, a humiliating experience going to doctors and trying to find answers. Most doctors were quick to say that it was a psychosomatic disease.
Okay.
Were quick to suggest that I try therapy as a means of treating it. But overall, it took me a couple years to even come across the name chronic fatigue syndrome. It was really only because of a online community of people that I ever learned of this disease. And but until, you know, even today, I don't really have a doctor that recognizes the severity of this disease. So it's very difficult to find treatment. You're really left on your own with one of the most stigmatized and mysterious diseases of our time. So it's really a lot of turning to the internet yourself, to this online community of patients, looking for possible treatments or lifestyle changes that can help improve the quality of your life.
There's an emotionally challenging but informative documentary film on ME/CFS called Unrest. I saw it as very effective and hard to watch sometimes, but that's good. And it's directed by a protagonist who has the disease. Kelly, could you describe the film and tell us where you fall on the spectrum of sufferers represented?
Sure. Unrest tells the first-person story of Jennifer Brea and her husband, Omar. Jennifer's working in her PhD at Harvard when she comes down with this mysterious illness that leaves her bedridden. Disbelieved by doctors, she turns the camera on herself and discovers millions of online people who suffer from this invisible disease. This movie has screened theatrically in cities all over the world and is really a part of a global impact campaign that aims to increase awareness, education, research, and funding around ME.
Okay. I'm going to take a moment here to remind our viewers and especially our radio listeners that we're talking about chronic fatigue syndrome with family physician with UP Holistic Medicine, Dr. Scott Dowdy, chronic fatigue syndrome patient and activist Kelly Parks, who joins us via Zoom in Berlin, and with me on the panel, Mining Journal staff writer Christy Bleck. How does one challenged by CFS attend to the practical life activities we all take for granted? Kelly, I'm thinking about marriage, employment, keeping a household, maybe even entertainment, that sort of thing. What's an ordinary day like for you?
Sure. Okay. Well, just to give you an idea, before I became sick with this disease, I lived a very active and adventurous life. The things that once brought me joy, say a night out dancing or meeting out with friends or going snowboarding, playing a game of tennis, these are things that make me much sicker when I engage in them. So, and I'm lucky because I've never been house or bed bound like so many others who suffer from this disease. I'm on the moderate side of things, and I am still able to work a few hours a week, although it does have a very negative impact on my health. If you can remind me where we were again, I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah, I'm just asking about what an ordinary day looks like for you.
Okay, yeah, that's right. And I think you asked about employment too. Most people, unfortunately, lose their place of employment or are unable to work anymore. They often may have to move back in with their parents because caring for themselves is much too much, let alone just trying to keep up with household work. It can be very, very difficult on relationships. You have to imagine when doctors are not acknowledging this as an organic disease, friends and family also start questioning whether it's real. So it's an extremely isolating disease. And out of necessity, people are forced to have to spend a lot of time alone because something that might be considered relaxing or enjoyable for someone who is healthy, an evening with friends, watching a movie, these can be activities that can actually cause a crash an overall worsening of symptoms.
I see. The documentary portrays a kind of worldwide network of patients and advocates focused on personal support and education. You've taken further steps in actively promoting better public understanding and research and that sort of thing. What sorts of challenges does that present to you? I mean, being active in that way.
Well, it's really difficult. And, you know, there's many of us for the world. And that's exciting about this movie is it's really ignited this movement. And patients and allies all over the world are doing what they can. Patients come from all types of backgrounds. Many highly successful professionals who've had to leave their employment because they are no longer able to continue working because of the disease. And so you see people from all over doing what they can. And often that's just small bits before they need to step back and rest again. But we're really just sort of coming together, uniting and taking the little bit that everyone can give and using that to propel us forward and move this and take this movement forward.
Okay. Let me speak with Dr. Dowdy here. A good way to describe the research effort to beat CFS is interdisciplinary. That's the term that I saw used recently when I read an article on the ME-CFS symposium at Stanford University last August, which drew world experts, including a couple of Nobel Prize winners and people from different fields, all focused on, in this particular conference, a molecular approach to the disease. Where does that take us in terms of better understanding of CFS, this interdisciplinary focus?
The team is on the field, and it looks like a game that other smart people might want to get in on, too.
Okay.
Not because they're going to make a gazillion dollars, but because this is real science at work.
It's a lot of scientific territory.
It's a lot of territory. Mm-hmm. And the roster at that interdisciplinary symposium was impressive from one side to the other. Engineers working on technology pieces for diagnosis and monitoring and treatment, and then all the immunologists and molecular biologists and mitochondrial experts.
Wow. Yeah.
This is really getting down to some nitty-gritty work about human health.
Okay. And the mitochondrial thing connection is that's a kind of an energy focus right there, isn't it?
That's right.
A study of mitochondria.
Right. Mitochondria are key to energy production in the cell. So if a cell is going to function the way it's meant to function, the mitochondria have to be ready to go.
Okay. I was thinking about, you know, looking at the 30 years, the most recent 30 years, what might have been different from 80 years ago? And a couple of things stand out quickly. One is big data. The fact that now we have the resources for gathering huge amounts of data on various people and conditions and cases. And the other is the technology that in some ways makes that possible and advanced technology in the medical field itself. What do you look at in terms of the impact of those things? And is that a part of the message that we should be getting from this effort?
Yes. Before we knew what genetics really was about in terms of mapping the mm-hmm. genome, we would have taken something like this and said, maybe it's genetic.
Okay.
And that would have ended the conversation. Now, people are apt to assume there's a genetic component, and even with all the work that's already been done, the question of where on the genome this might rest is still being explored.
The leader of that particular symposium was a guy named Ron Davis, a biochemist from Stanford University. What do we know about him? He seems to be quite a fire plug there.
We know that he has an impressive scientific background, and what brought him to ME-CFS was his own son's condition.
Okay.
So he lives the life daily of the father of somebody who he's watching and has watched in a thriving state mm-hmm. and now in a state of great dysfunction.
Oh, wow. The research effort would seem to be greater and more unified than ever, but Where are we now on anything corresponding to a cure, a unified diagnosis, and a common approach to treatment for CFS?
We are thinking about putting on the baby shoes to begin taking the baby steps. There's certainly a lot of information that has already been looked at, but no one has an answer or a key to the solution. It's really going to continue to be a group effort with technology and science from multiple arenas.
Now, reading about the symposium, you can find that there are millions of dollars in grants mentioned, but most of them are directed at various details of the puzzle and still early. And advocates frequently claim, and this is a big deal, that studies on ME-CFS are woefully underfunded. Now, why is that, and what is it going to take to change that?
You had some data on that, actually.
Yeah, I think it was National Multiple Sclerosis Society gets $115 million per year in public research funding. Mm-hmm. ME-CFS gets $6 million a year.
Okay.
So you do the math.
Yeah, it really
and that
is.
Although ME-CFS is three times as common as ME, and scores in life quality measures are much lower on the level.
On that particular, those in that comparison, is that changing? Any predictions on what it's going to take in terms of funding to beat CFS?
I'm not sure, but we just know we need to invest more in science. We need that biomarker.
Okay.
Very important.
All right. We have just about a minute left. Where would you hope we'd be on this effort in 10 years, Dr. Dowdy?
In 10 years, ME-CFS patients will be accepted by their communities and by their physicians as having a real disease. That's one thing. Hard to say what we're going to get in terms of better understanding, cure, but the ball is rolling mm-hmm. toward that, and I think with more funding, that can only get clearer.
Okay. I'm afraid we have to leave it there for time. We've been talking about chronic fatigue syndrome with family physician and UP Holistic Medicine, Dr. Scott Dowdy. Chronic fatigue syndrome patient and activist, Kelly Parks, who joined us via Zoom from Berlin, Germany, and with me on the panel, Mind Journal staff writer, Christy Beck. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Hart. This is MediaMeet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.